So welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 8. Once again, before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Squamakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen land of the Squamak people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now today we have a quartet of guests on the show, and like a musical quartet, they are all working closely together to create something harmonious and beautiful. In this case, the beautiful something is better hospital food. For many decades, putting the words hospital food and good together would create an oxymoron. Hospital food has become for decades synonymous with inadequate nutrition and even outright ill health. Studies from 30 or 40 years ago revealed that the longer you spent time in the hospital, the more your health declined. Our guests today are working hard to reverse that image and that reality. Joining us today on Zoom, in alphabetical order, are dietitian Elaine Chu, surgical resident and PhD student Annie Lalonde, chef and food manager Jose Moray, and family physician Eileen Wong. Each of our guests, in their own way and from their own background, is working to transform food in the BC's Lower Mainland institutional healthcare system, which is a mouthful in itself, into something that is nutritious and delicious, as well as culturally appropriate and, most important of all, good for planet Earth. So welcome all of you to Food Conversations.
Thank you very much for having us. Such a pleasure to be here.
Good Friday morning, everyone.
It is Good Friday morning. Now, it's funny, when I was preparing notes for this discussion, I thought of one of those jokes that you hear all the time. People say things like, a surgeon, a chef, a family doctor, and a dietitian walk into a bar. The surgeon says to the chef, how's your appendix and your gallbladder? And then the family doctor says to the dietitian, food? What's food? And on we go. So I didn't do that. That's the extent of my attempt at humor. But we're going to learn today from our four guests how much hard work is actually going into making food a transformative presence in the healthcare system. So let's begin with a problem with food in healthcare. First of all, doctors have traditionally received no training in food or nutrition science, period. Eileen, talk about your training as a physician. What you learned or didn't learn when you were in the training around food?
Certainly when I... Good morning, everybody. My name is Eileen Wong. I'm a family physician who practices in the Lower Mainland. And yes, going back to medical school, which is many decades ago, we learned nothing about food other than that food in the hospital cafeteria was bad.
And so I remember our, that.
Decades ago hasn't changed. And so I regretfully say that unfortunately, in our medical education, there's very little spoken about or taught about nutrition and food and how important it is in the patient journey.
Annie, you've been enmeshed in postgraduate medical education for about 5 years. Before that, did you have any training in nutrition? I mean, you're the young member of this crowd.
Unfortunately, not a whole lot. We did have a couple of hours on nutrition, talking about, you know, key studies and principles, especially around like balance and diets. But I think the movement and shifting to viewing diets as more like whole foods and dietary patterns rather than the focus on individual nutrients hadn't really transpired into the education that we received.
When you got into clinical medicine, what did you, and you saw patients eating food, and you probably have to worry about making them NPO at times because of your work as a surgical resident. What sort of things were you noticing about that, as you got into it?
Well, that was certainly a turning point for me when I realized that we're asking our patients every morning how they're eating. And typically the answer that we're getting is, well, not a whole lot. I'm not feeling great. And also, what I'm getting isn't really appetizing to me. It's not enticing me to want to eat more. And I think we've, in a way, unfortunately accepted that as a status quo. Like that's kind of the expectation that we have, is that our patients will eat better when they return home. And it feels like a lost opportunity to actually get them to heal better when they're actually in care.
Now, Elaine, you have a background in nutrition and food science, 20 years of working in hospital food management. What priorities around food in that system were in place when you started out? you know, the sort of attitudes towards food in the system, as it were?
From the food and nutrition team perspective, the vision has always been to provide that good food to the patient to help them get better. That never changed. That will not change neither. And I would say that feeding sick people is always a tough job. We all have been sick ourselves, and we all know that it's just the natural decrease of appetite that happens when you're not well, you just don't want to eat. And so I think that's the situation that make our job very tough. Sometimes whatever that we feel good, want to eat as a healthy person might not be what it is for the sick person.
Elaine, did you have people talking to you about sort of cost recovery and keeping costs down? I know in our hospital, when I arrived here, it was 40 years ago, that was very much on the dietitian, the chief dietitian's mind. Did you get that kind of feedback?
Yeah, totally. So the food service budget is sitting as support services, non-clinical, right? Mm. So I think that determines its priority and the status in terms of whether and how important it is, resources-wise.
Isn't that interesting that it wouldn't be part of clinical medicine, that food would somehow be an adjunct to the actual treatment? It has nothing to do with the direct treatment. Jose,
Jose,
you're a trained chef. Which is, in some ways, in my mind, almost seems like a bit of a liability coming to a hospital food system. But nevertheless, you've also had international experience, and you've been immersed in healthcare in the hospital system for a couple of decades. What's it like looking at the world through a chef's eyes to come into the hospital food world?
I think the biggest thing is, and what I'm also trying to change, is the presentation. And to build the relationship with food. Because when you're in restaurants, you have to get it looking nice. You have to get it tasting nice and build that expectation. So when the customer orders it, they expect something good and they get something good. Whereas now, I think in a hospital, the expectation is they're not going to get anything good. And so you're already at a disadvantage. So I think that that's what we have to do, is increase that relationship with food and the presentation.
You know, it's interesting that the idea that food would look appetizing is not considered important. Again, we're talking about problems now, so I think it's appropriate to bring that up, that if the food doesn't look good, it's irrelevant, which it never has been in human existence. So let's do another issue that I think is a considerable problem. It's very much a practical problem when you're talking about food from the point of view of the planet. Jose, and that's food waste. And Jose, you're a director of three major hospital systems and long-term care institutions, and so you're acutely aware of hospital food waste. How much is there in terms of percentage or volume in terms of food waste?
On average, it's about 30% of what the waste of the actual food that comes in. And I did a quick calculation the other day. It's like $500,000 just for our one hospital, not all three. One hospital is just thrown away.
It's astonishing.
And we're not even a big hospital. When you look at some of the other hospitals, which are much bigger, I mean, it's probably double that.
Would you, from working outside the healthcare system when you were a chef initially, is there more waste or less waste in sort of the restaurant, hotel, food, whatever business? Is there any comparison there?
There used to be a lot of waste, especially when the Michelin star restaurants, because everything has to be perfect. And to get one carrot, for example, they probably threw out five to get that one perfect one. But I think now people are paying more attention to waste and the cost. I mean, it's all money.
Yeah, it is money. I hope I'm looking at everybody on screen. I want to see if this question registers. Are you seeing composting of food waste taking place in the hospital system? If you are, please hold your hand up, and I'll tell listeners that there's a few. Well, my hand was up, and there's four other hands. So we're getting to the real world now. Eileen, your full title is Physician Lead in Quality Improvement for Providence Healthcare. When you were growing up, in your own personal life, because your cultural background is Chinese, was that something that was frowned upon, you know, throwing food away or not eating everything on your plate and that kind of thing?
Definitely. I might just share a little bit about how I became involved in food, because really as a physician, you're dealing with medications and medical conditions. Yep. But as I observed in long-term care, seeing this food being wasted and uneaten, unloved and untouched, I thought, how can I improve this? Because growing up as an Asian, we did not waste food. I come from an immigrant family, and really we could not afford to waste food. So this to me was really an anathema. And so I sought, that's how I sought to improve my quality improvement experience, to see if I could address this issue.
So Eileen, how did that work out in your family? What would your mother or your father say if you were not eating the food on your plate?
I'll give you an anecdote. The rice bowl had to be completely clean, not even one speck of rice. They would say to you, if you leave a grain of rice or any grains of rice, those would be pimples on your future husband's face. So we would use anecdotes like that.
I can concur with that.
Elaine, did you have to go through the same thing?
Oh, same.
Did you have pimples on the face of your future husband? Any?
He has, yes.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. But
yeah,
you've got
the
same
message. We say the same to my kids. So,
So what do you say to your kids? You don't say, I hope pimples in the face of your future spouse.
It will be to the same effect, though.
Yes.
Oh, dear me. Every culture has its own way of doing things, doesn't it? The wasteful system is, of course, amplified by the fact that physicians know very little about nutrition. And, of course, that's coupled with the waste. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster, and I have no hesitation as a physician in saying that very thing. So I decided to call you the team of hospital food busters. You're addressing the ghosts of waste and ignorance in the food system in the healthcare world. Now, all of you have quite disparate backgrounds, but you're also very much in the same page, which is very much the way musical quartet works. You play different instruments, but you're playing the same tune. Let's discuss a little bit about each one of you so that listeners know that you didn't spring out of the ground fully formed as administrative people or residents in the healthcare system. Now, Jose, you were born and raised in Zimbabwe. And of course, as soon as I knew that, I wondered, what did you know about local food in that part of the world?
Yes, and that's everything. I don't remember anything that we bought was not local. I mean, just driving out of the main city, there were farms, huge farms, and you saw chickens, pigs, cows, all free range, nothing really in cages. We used to buy our fruit and veg off the side of the street from street vendors. And the best thing, like ground nuts or peanuts and macadamias, you buy them by the pillowcase. Raw.
By the pillowcase. So
you'd go and cook them cook them yourself. But the thing is that you only bought what you needed. Now I find you go to the Costco, you have to buy a huge box and a lot of times you don't use it or you take out too much and there's waste. Whereas we only bought what we needed.
I'll just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with dietitian Elaine Chu, surgical resident, PhD student Annie Lalonde, chef and food manager Jose Moray, and family physician Eileen Wong, who are working on the food system in hospitals in the Lower Mainland. Jose, did you have an early aspiration to be a chef? Was that something that sprang into your mind as you were out collecting pillowcases full of macadamias?
Yeah. No, it's sort of weird how it started, because I left home when I was quite young and went down to the south of the country. And at that time, there was really not much you could do work-wise where you couldn't get accommodation of food. So I thought, well, I'll go into hotel management. So they give you accommodation and they feed you. So I thought that was great. And then I just got into that. And the funny thing, how I started as a chef, I managed the restaurant and I thought I knew how to cook. And the actual chef went home sick, and I thought, okay, I can do this. I couldn't. I comped probably about 3/4 of the meals. I had to give away free, so I thought I had to go to school to learn.
One of the themes in life is serendipity. I think it's a guiding principle for the functioning of the universe. Serendipity, things happen, and then you respond to them. But that sounds pretty good. Now, Annie, You were born and raised in Montreal, where we had the pleasure of living for about 7 years. You got your medical degree at McGill. Mm-hmm. Was food something in your family? Was it a deal?
Yeah, food was a big part of how I grew up. In part because I grew up with food allergies, a lot of them, which was very stressful for my parents. And I don't think I fully appreciate how stressful it was at the time. Though looking back, I really have to give them credit because it was hard. So being allergic to nuts and peanuts and fish and seafood and poultry and milk and eggs.
Dear me.
We cook a lot at home. And cooking is also something that was a really big part of getting together with my family. My grandmother passed on her love of cooking to many of my cousins and I. And it's something that also brought a lot of our friends and family together. So we'd have a lot of dinners.
There's a certain self-consciousness around food, obviously, for you. But you also liked sports and you particularly liked skiing. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it's no accident that you migrated across to this side of the Rocky Mountains. Having lived in Quebec, the mountains you sort of drive by and say, was that a mountain or just a hill? But out in BC, you know, the two tectonic plates meeting and up go the mountains, and they're big and they're steep. So I did a lot of skiing. Why did you decide to go into surgery?
That's a good question. I really fell in love with anatomy. I love the breadth of what we do in surgery. I also like the immediate reward in the sense where you see a problem and you're able to act on it right away and provide immediate benefit to the patient.
But usually. Then you started to get distracted by things when you got into, especially when you came out to BC. Yeah. And you noticed things like unnecessary interventions or tests and then food. I mean, you would have noticed food, obviously. And you talked to patients a little bit and things started to shape your thinking. And it ended up really adding a big pile of new studies to first a master's and then a PhD. And the PhD title is a wonderful title, PhD in Resources, Environment, and Sustainability. Now, there were never any courses like that when I went into medical school nearly half a century ago. I'm jealous. But what was it that triggered you to say, okay, I'm going to branch out. I'm going to do something different?
Well, Warren, I was getting honestly quite frustrated with the number of ways in which I felt there was challenges in sustainability in healthcare. And while I do believe that we should do everything that we can to improve the health of the patient that is in front of us, I think we also have a responsibility and duty to all patients who come after them, so that we should be mindful of not harming patients who come after through the interventions that we do. And that means making sure that we don't do too much, making sure that we're providing the right amount of care and that we're providing in the least environmentally impactful way.
Now, Elaine, you were born and raised in Hong Kong and came to Canada after high school. Why did you choose dietetics as your direction?
That was accidental.
I love it. Thank you. You've just saved everybody's mind by saying that. What was it?
I wanted to go into a science subject that did not require physics. That was the premise.
You were a physics phobic individual.
Totally. So physics 11 and 12 just took me away. So when I went through the whole university calendar, at that time there was a physical book called calendar.
I remember it well.
The only science subject that I could find that did not require physics as the prerequisite was dietetics. So I thought, hey, that is it.
I love the hand of serendipity moving people along. It's a wonderful thing.
And I thought food, good. We all eat and we all enjoy good food. And so why not? So that brought me into this journey accidentally.
Well, that's good. Thank you. You've just, all the listeners to this show are saying, oh, I'm not alone. People do things for reasons that don't immediately make sense, but they in the end do. Now, your official title is long, and it's Director of Food Services Transformation and Strategic Planning. Good Lord, I would love to have a title like that. It's like opening up the entire universe to your interest. So how did you go from doing dietetics as a study to ending up in this really lofty and wonderfully open role.
I think I have the dream job of the world, but that's also accidental how it all happened. When I finished my dietetic training, I didn't want to go to do clinical because I had a very negative experience through my internship in the clinical setting. And so I just went into food service as a default, accidentally. And so I started to like it. Connecting with people, making the food happen, right, in an actual plate. So I thought that is very interesting. And then eventually I became this management person in the hospital food system. And then eventually explore opportunities, a new project, innovative way of doing certain things. And then eventually brought me into this dream job of the world, a job that focused on transformation, innovative and strategic.
So was this title something that was given to you, or did you have a little bit of a hand in being able to say, well, why don't we call it this?
It's a newly created position for Fraser Health Food and Dietitian Services. And I went through a competition process and got the job.
Well, if I had a name of a title like that, I would be running miles to be able to join it. Now, Aileen, born and raised in Alberta, came to BC, wisely realized that the topography was much more interesting. Now, much of your work was in emergency rooms. You did the EM addition to the family physician, to call the family physician. Now, that's a long way from where you are now. What was the transition for you from, you know, episodic emergency care I'll read your title, Long-Term Care Physician Lead for Quality Improvement for Providence Healthcare. Now, that's a mouthful, and it could cover a multitude of sins or virtues. But how did you go from emergency medicine to something like that, it's all about human health, but it's a different angle.
It is quite different. Thank you for that question, Warren. I started in emergency medicine because I actually worked in Banff, Alberta, for a long time. And during that time as a rural physician, semi-rural, you actually had to work in the emergency department. So I became interested in that, went back for training because I realized I was inadequate. But after a few years living in a small town, I decided I would move to my dream town, which is Vancouver. And so I did that. And then when I went to Vancouver, I think after a few years, unfortunately, just burned out from emergency medicine and gave it up altogether. Mm. Then went back as a hospitalist. And gradually through my journey, I entered into elder care, where I was privileged, I would say, to serve the most vulnerable populations of our in BC.
And that was something that struck you, their vulnerability, the fact that they have no control, as it were, over so many parts of their lives.
That is correct. Yeah. Because food is such an important, vital part of their day-to-day, I would say, living quality of life, which is why I chose to address food as a quality of life issue.
And picking up on what Jose was saying earlier about how food is presented in places outside the healthcare system, it's a big deal. How you present food really matters. And you became aware of that yourself. You were sensitized to that because it isn't always presented very well in healthcare.
Yeah, it isn't. And so I initially did my food quality improvement projects in long-term care, where I surveyed residents and the staff about what was important for the food experience. And although we feel that presentation may be important, what's most important to patients is actually taste, temperature, and texture.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And frankly, of course, Aileen, for everybody. I mean, we all pay attention to that. It's a really critical thing. Let's move on a little bit to talk about the planetary health aspect of what you're doing. I think it's maybe the newest kid in the block in terms of how we think about our world and our lives. And it's an evolutionary, in some ways, a revolutionary change in the thinking and actions of many, many people. The notion that's bound up in planetary health is that everything we do has to sustain and avoid disrupting planetary systems because, frankly, we're wholly 100% dependent on those planetary systems for our survival. So, Elaine, 3 or 4 years ago, you said you were kind of resistant to this notion, the planetary, you know, broadening the vision to include the planet. But you got another act of serendipity. You got into it, and things started to change. So what was that elevation in your thinking? How did that move?
Right. So up to that point, my angle into environment, planetary health, was always through the angle of waste. Mm. It was always through that angle, and that is always this eagerness to reduce waste. And that's not interesting. Who likes to count garbage to find out how much is there and then how much we can reduce? And so there wasn't too much future or hope in that aspect. However, from 3-4 years ago, another angle came in, which is the angle from food. Food connects people's health and planetary health, and it also connects to enjoyment. So very interestingly, when that connection happened, then the world is like bigger than ever to me in terms of planetary health and environmental sustainability. We can now put this very interesting, enjoyable connecting piece, food, to bring it all together. Food has a negative effect to the environment. Put it this way, food could have a negative effect to the environment. Food could also bring positive effect to the environment.
Now, Eileen, one of the features of what the work you do is quality improvement. That's sort of a focus. Would you just give a 25 words or less definition for listeners who aren't familiar with the way the healthcare system works, a definition of quality improvement? This is your skill testing question.
Yes. Quality improvement is a scientific approach to problem solving. It's similar to research, but it is not research. Quality improvement seeks to improve within a system with existing, I would say, processes that occur. So what you're doing is you're measuring to see if a change that you make is an actual change for positive or negative.
No, you definitely exceeded your 25 words, but you're forgiven. Okay,
sorry.
Because it was very clear. No, you made it very clear. Now, you were noticing food quality and issues, especially COVID-19, that really sort of brought some things out. How did that focus your mind in terms of you starting to say, okay, let's get serious about this?
During COVID, long-term care residents were not able to have visits from their families, who often helped with the meal experience. And so the social aspect of the food experience became very, very evident. And so it's not just measuring food waste, which of course is very important as an objective measurement, but also measuring the interpersonal relationships. So again, it's all part of qualitative measurements, quantitative measurements. So it's a holistic approach to, again, the food experience and measuring it.
I love the word holistic. You can't say it too often in my mind. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with dietitian Elaine Chu, surgical resident and PhD student Annie Lalonde, chef and food manager Jose Moray, and family physician Eileen Wong. Now, a couple of years ago, Eileen, you started the Vegetarian Week Project. What was that all about?
It's Eileen here.
Yes.
What I did was
Eileen and Elaine, they're just close enough that I could say Eileen and Elaine. Yes,
Eileen. So in Province Healthcare, as part of Vancouver Coastal Health, there was repatriation of the food services staff and food services provider back into the hospital system in June 2022. I saw it as an opportunity to then see if we could measure pre-transition and post-transition using vegetarian week menu. So for 1 week only, lunch entrees were by default a plant-based menu item if the patients themselves did not choose it. We measured their waste at baseline in 2022, during COVID, and in 2023, which was during, I would say, a little bit post-COVID and during that.
Right.
What we found was that the rehabilitation patients, which we measured their food consumption, actually wasted more of the vegetarian entree items. We thought, why?
Naughty patients.
Because we're trying to improve their health, trying to improve their planetary health. But it was because I think they were unfamiliar with the food items that were offered, some of them. And also perhaps it wasn't there to their liking. And interestingly, the vegetarian patients also wasted just as much as the non-vegetarian patients, despite having vegetarian options, probably because it wasn't their version of vegetarian food. So in a nutshell, it just showed that we do have to involve patients as the center of any menu planning and changes along with food services who do the operations.
Now that is a magical statement. That is something that just has not happened enough in the healthcare system, that we actually include patients in the decision-making process. One of the comments you made in your remarks before we came on air was that balancing patient eating habits with planetary health is not easy, especially because people don't always think about that. You know, they haven't been thinking about that for a long time. Now, Annie, when you got into your residency program, where was there a turning point? Like anything that sort of triggered you? We're talking about serendipity here, so it can be anything you like. But I know that Andrea McNeil was working on stuff like this, especially she did a study of operating room impacts. But what for you got you going?
Well, I think meeting Dr. Andrea McNeil was a point of serendipity in my path. As I told you, I started noticing the lack of sustainability in what we do, a lot through waste initially.
All kinds of waste.
All kinds of waste, and especially in the operating room, like we generate a lot of waste. And I started getting really frustrated. At some point, I decided that maybe getting frustrated wasn't actually going to change the situation, and I could probably try to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And that was the time where Dr. Andrea McNeil's work got published. And there is a serendipitous moment of, hey, I could actually align what I want to do at a professional role with my personal interests in sustainability. And really, I also kind of stumbled onto food as a focus for my what was intended to be a master's and turned out to be a bit of a longer detour. When I decided to take some time away, because doing this off the side of my desk didn't feel like I could dive sufficiently deep enough. Yeah. And I was talking to Dr. McNeil about opportunities, and we'd been doing work on blood work, and I felt like it's interesting, but it's not necessarily where my true passion lies. And I had just seen a slew of patients who hadn't been eating very well that week. I thought, hey, what about food? And at that time, the Eat Lancet Commission, looking at how we could sustainably feed 10 billion people by 2050, had just gotten published. And then it was like opening Pandora's box. Like I started to peek in, and then suddenly all this wealth of knowledge around the importance of food for patients and like avoiding malnutrition and their recovery and the relationship between food and planetary health and in hospitals. And that was a big aha moment for me. And like knowing that, I couldn't go back.
So you started out, you ventured directly into a master's degree, and then somehow that morphed into a PhD. How does that happen? How do you morph a master's into a PhD? Especially while you're being a surgical resident.
Well, I put my surgical residency on pause, just so we're clear. So I don't have an infinite number of hours in my day, even though I wish I did. So I continued to do call during that, but a much more limited amount. I came into the initial master's program with a pretty clear plan of what I wanted to accomplish, which was to improve the sustainability of offerings for patients while ensuring that we could do that in a way that met their needs both from an acceptability and enjoyment perspective, but also from a nutritional perspective. Hmm. And I proposed a project to my supervisory committee, who told me, Annie, this is great. This is also not a master's project. This is going to take you years. And I thought, do you want to do a PhD with this? I'm like, well,
you followed the advice of your elders. Well done.
Exactly. I got roped in.
Now, Jose, your path was from food outside the healthcare system. But over the years, you've actually immersed yourself in all the official, you know, qualifications, MBA in healthcare, master's in community nutrition, bachelor's degree in food and nutrition science. What was the transition from working in food outside the healthcare system to working with food inside? How did that process take place?
Again, serendipity, I suppose.
Serendipity. Thank you.
In Europe, especially in the high class, like the Michelin star restaurants, between 30, 35, you're too old. They get rid of you. And I thought, well, rather than be on the street, because I have seen people, not on the street, but they become agent chefs, where you just phone up and you get a chef. They don't have that system here, but they have it there.
So it's very insecure life.
Yeah, it is. And so I went back, thought, well, I better get back, you know, go back to school and get a real job. So I did. I started off in London and got the bachelor's. I came to Canada, and of course they didn't recognize it. So
we're so picky, aren't we? It's ridiculous.
Go back. So I then did the master's in health science and became a dietitian. So I thought, well, I might as well at the same time. So I did that. And then started out in the airlines. I worked in the airlines. You know, the main job was to reduce, I think they had 57 different diets, and they wanted to put down to 10. So
that was
the main job, to get that down.
Reduce choice, everybody. Let's reduce choice. Yes.
And I worked at, well, it's Gate Gourmet now, 30,000 meals a day they were sending out. So I was quite busy. But then the sad thing, the waste, how much waste that comes back. And any international flight, everything gets garbage, whether it's sealed or not. And it's just like, it just drove me insane.
And so much of it is in individual doses, if I can call it that. I mean, the little packages of things. Oh, you know.
So I thought, well, I need to do that. But of course, there's no opportunity then because it's just profit-based. So they don't really care that much. And then I started off in healthcare, but did a lot of time in mental health, the last sort of 18 years in mental health, which was scary at the beginning because it was like I worked in a criminally insane hospital. But it was very eye-opening because anyone who's worked in mental health know that these people do not have filters.
Yes.
So they tell you exactly what they think, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that was very eye-opening because I would say, okay, let's try this. And we'd put out a menu item and they would tell me, yes, it's great. Or, you know, I wouldn't feed it to my dog in more colorful language than that. But and we eventually got it to the point where they actually ate the food.
You know, it's interesting. You're describing real-time patient engagement in the fact that there was no way they could not tell you. And it's funny because we would probably have a sort of notion that people who were mentally unwell were somehow unable to be realistic. And yet, in a certain way, they were far more realistic than people often are in a hospital setting where you're being well-behaved, you know, the social norms, you don't interrupt people and all that kind of stuff. Wonderful. Another serendipitous movement that's changed things.
And one quick sentence, they have no reason to please you.
Yes, indeed.
Where a lot of other patients will say the things they think you want to hear. These ones, they don't.
What brought you into the sort of more standard hospital setting?
It was a promotion. So it became from manager to director. And the funny thing is I'm never been that very good with mums and babies. So I am still sticking with the mental health because we do have mental health wards here.
Yes.
But I'm getting more used to it. Speaking to mothers and babies.
Old dog learning new tricks. Well, we can all do that. Speaking as an old dog myself, I guess. Let's talk a little bit about some specific projects. Elaine, you have just completed a very successful Dietitian Planetary Health Recipe Contest. Why don't you talk about that?
Okay, so it just got concluded as of yesterday. We did the final event, which is called Taste and Vote, which we have all the food samples made and be at the event from the 8 final recipes and the 7 dietitians involved, and invite everyone from the hospital to give their comments and give their vote. So that was yesterday.
Who's everyone? Is that patients, managers, doctors, everybody?
Yes, everyone that show up in the cafeteria, so they can join our event to try the food.
How many came?
Over 400 in the 2 hours. So we had a full house, like hustling and bustling, and it was a great event, very engaging. And so the idea came that I would like to engage the dietitians from all practice areas on this planetary health movement. and that we are in the hospital setting, we are the food expert. Dietitians should be the food experts, and that we have this thing, that what I was mentioning, that the food that connects people's health and planetary health. Mm-hmm. I think we all know how to connect that to people's health, but can we also connect it to planetary health, right? And so in order to engage them, we thought, okay, dietitians like food, dietitians want to be involved about food, dietitians want to have a say on what is going on the patient menu. Why do we just bring it all together and make it a recipe contest, and that the winner's recipe will go on to the patient menu?
Elaine, every listener on this listening to this show wants to know what was in the recipe that won.
What? Since we have hundreds of voting forms that we are tabulating, I don't have the final result yet.
You don't even know. Everybody's sitting here in bated breath.
We are working through all the voting forms, and I chose a traditional way of paper forms for people to put in their comments.
Paper, and so we've heard of it.
Yes, yes.
The paper moves.
Yeah, good.
Computers were supposed to help us get rid of paper, but they haven't. They've made me facilitate its consumption. Okay, why don't you describe what you thought, because you saw the recipes, right? And you saw the final product. What would you say was the recipe you thought was the winner?
I think one would be the silky chocolate pudding, which is made with three simple ingredients: dark chocolate, coconut milk, and maple syrup. That one I know is going to win. And then another one is a carrot ginger lentil soup, full of good stuff, fresh, tasty, the ginger flavor just pop, and we wash and peel and chop all the fresh carrot for that soup. That makes a difference compared to frozen carrots.
Oh my goodness. I haven't had
another
breakfast.
Another one I think will be the lentil shepherd's pie. Also a good twist of using lentil into an entree.
I'm going to remind listeners again that I'm talking with dietitian Elaine Chu, surgical resident, PhD student Annie Lalonde, chef and food manager Jose Murray, and family physician Eileen Wong, who are working studiously to change the healthcare system and food and its relationship. Well, hopefully breakfast will come in not too distant a time, and I'll be able to handle all the taste bud activity that I've been hearing generated by your comments. Now, Eileen and Jose, you both worked on a report that has just come out, a document for the Ministry of Health on planetary health and healthcare. Why don't you talk a little bit about what was in that report and what you hope it will achieve? A report that came out on September the 20th.
Yeah, Provincial Nutrition Standard.
That is the BC Provincial Nutrition Standard, the hot off the press document.
Hot off the press.
Yes, yes, that we, all the health organizations across the province, the food operator nutrition department will be working towards as our vision and goals.
I think they are expecting from a physician's viewpoint how they could improve the nutritional standards for acute care at the time, because that's what the publication is. Mm-hmm. And they're working on long-term care as well, which I wasn't involved in the long-term care one, but it's coming up too as well.
It's interesting because you do a lot of work in long-term care. They could have asked you lots of good questions. So Elaine, say a little bit about what you think the primary content of this report is all about.
This provincial nutrition standard, the hot off the press one, compared to previous version, this has a lot to connect to what works well for the actual patients, and also connects to the sustainability aspects of our global wellness. And I think it is a great transformation from the angle of just looking at from a clinical, like, number nutrient perspective. So this one is a lot more practical, down to earth, and wanting to be relevant. So I have a lot of hope. And for Fraser Health, we are going to map out all our existing priorities to be under that framework.
What was it, Elaine? What was it in this report that made it relate to what patients, what would work with patients? Was there patient input? Was there a special section for patient input?
Every session, every one of the seven sessions has fingerprints of patient relevance in it. And some have bigger priorities like relating to that. For example, respecting patients' choices. So one of the standard we'll be talking about, when at all possible, whenever possible, respect what patients want to choose and provide that to them.
And were patients actually physically involved? Do they make submissions to the
choices?
Around the report? Yeah.
That I don't know, but I'm quite sure that there will be some patient advisory components in this nutrition standard. And so a lot of the health authorities, we are already having choice system that patient can input into what they would like for their meal, like the day of.
Jose, what is your perception of this report? You've been outside and inside the healthcare system. What do you think?
I know there's sort of eight standards or seven to eight standards that Elaine was talking about, but the one that really stood out for me was, I can read it verbatim. It says, facilities have systems in place to support positive eating experiences and reduce barriers to eating. Hmm. Because as we know, if food's not eaten, there's no nutritious value to it. And what we've trialed here, and it actually works, is we bring family members in to eat with the patients, so they make it more of a relationship, and they can talk, and they actually are eating more food. Whether it's, you know, because as kids, maybe the mother's telling them you got to eat your broccoli before you get out of bed. I don't know, but the actual food waste is going down.
There might be even comments about pimples in the face of her new husband. Yeah. Who knows? It seems to you that okay, I'm going to use transformational. Would you say that at least the content, whatever it produces, has a kind of a transformational quality to it?
Yes, definitely, because the ones before were all very clinically based, much easier to measure, but you know, the outcomes weren't that good. Whereas I believe this one, once we get it going, I think the outcomes will be better.
Now, Annie, there's a group that really, you said, was a life, sort of life-changing, consciousness-changing, and that's a group called Nourish. Mm-hmm. Why don't you say a few words about Nourish? I mean, it's a great title. You don't have to think very much about it to know what it's all about.
Well, Nourish is a phenomenal organization. It started off as a community of practice of people who believe that food was a really important part of healthcare, and that food deserved to be celebrated and seen for all of the values that it brought to healthcare. It's since become a charitable organization, and they work nationwide to use food as a lever in healthcare to advance community health and well-being, promote equity, and mitigate climate change.
Let me ask you a question, because you made this point when you first mentioned it, that its core is all women. Now, Jose and I are going to have to just sit here and take our lumps. But that's important. I mean, a lot of the transformational changes that are going on around the whole planetary health movement are, in fact, being guided, shaped, directed, and promulgated by women. And, I mean, we're not talking about it for the first time. I've had other guests on the show who've made that point, and I see it in the work I've been doing over the years, that when it comes to actually saying the system isn't working, we're going to make a change, it's women who are saying it. Do you think that's relevant?
It is, and I think there's a couple of different dimensions here. Well, for one, the women that are leading this are wonderful systems thinkers. And I think part of the reason why Nourish is so impactful is because they embrace the complexity, and they encourage people who work with them to really see food for all of the different aspects that it has. So implications in terms of health, but in terms of community structure, in terms of food security, in terms of culture, in terms of planetary health. I mean, the other thing that we need to consider is that food has historically been, at least if we're thinking of like who provides and cooks in a house, has historically been more of a woman-focused role. And while chefs at a high level have typically been men, a lot of people who have been doing a lot of the work, both in dietetics, both in the home as well, have predominantly been women. Whether that's good or bad, I think it is just
I think women are often in a position where they have to think about 10 things at once, especially if there's kids involved. You know, you're a manager while somebody's tugging at your at your clothing saying, pay attention to me instead. And the male linear thinking, you know, approach isn't always the thing that works the best, especially when we're dealing with complex problems. Mm-hmm. But I mean, obviously both, and I would also add in all genders, sexes, and orientations are required to address these issues. Now, I'm just going to step back a little bit. The BC Green Care organization is kind of an amalgamation network of the Lower Mainland, the Fraser Health, Providence Healthcare, Provincial Health Service, and Vancouver Coastal Health, all together sort of linked in a sort of network. Mm. Now, they did a survey recently, and it showed that one of the questions on it was, would you be willing to try a sustainable plant-based food program in healthcare cafeterias? And something like two-thirds of people said yes. Now, I'm just going around the circle here. Eileen, what do you think about that? Do you think they were just being coerced into saying that, or do you think there's a real shift that's taking place?
I think there is really, truly a shift in this thinking, especially amongst younger people, because people do realize that the planet's health is at stake and how choosing carbon-intensive foods like beef is not a good choice. So I do think there is a true shift.
Elaine, what's your thought?
I totally agree. So I have held a couple food fairs at my hospital. The one that I mentioned about yesterday was the third one. And so the last one that we did, we specifically asked a question, because at the food fair, we have about 10 different plant-based items for participants to try. And so on my survey at that time, we asked whether they are incorporating plant-based already in their diet and whether they feel like they have learned more about plant-based and will be incorporating more after the event. And the response also shifted to be more often. Mm. So I think with knowledge, with introduction, with exposure, that will happen.
Jose, what's your thought? What's your thought about the attitudinal process? Is it moving? Is it stalled?
I think it's starting to move. Just as an example, we did a kids fair, because I am at BC Children, so we did a fair. And I did a different way of actually getting the results. I made them draw a picture rather than write things. So they all drew, most of them drew pictures, and it's from ages 2 to 13. And so many pictures had trees, with garbage with it, crossed through it, smiling faces, sun, outside pictures, outdoor pictures. And then we did an actual survey, and local food and sustainable food came up, like I think 58% of the surveys. And then I did a similar one with adults. Their local food was a bit lower, it was at 21%, but they were more interested in reducing and recycling, reducing waste and recycling. So that went up to 65%. So it was the difference between the two sort of demographics.
Did you get the adults to make pictures too?
No, they just wrote.
They would probably be embarrassed. They say, I don't draw pictures. I did that when I was a kid. I'll tell you,
pictures.
For adults to draw pictures, there's a discipline called art therapy. And it's very profoundly, it has a real gestalt that presents what's in your mind much better than sometimes you could do in words. Yeah. But probably they'd be embarrassed. Say, sorry, I can't draw. I don't know how to draw, et cetera, et cetera. Annie, I'm going to give you the last word. What do you see as the youngest member of our quartet today? What do you see in the process of evolution in thinking about how we do what we do in the healthcare system regarding food?
Well, I think for one thing, in a way, I see this as just having more choice, introducing more delicious ways of eating, opening our palates to other cultures, other recipes. And really the movement of eating in a way that's more sustainable isn't necessarily about removing options completely. There's a spectrum, but it's about reestablishing that balance between things that are healthful, that contribute directly to our well-being and that enhance the well-being of our planet, and limiting things that don't make us as healthy and that harm our planet more. Mm. And a lot of plant-based dishes are not necessarily as familiar to us when we come into it, but are delicious, nutritious. And I think it's all about good food. That's what we're trying to do here.
I think that's a good thing for it to be all about. Now, one question I have is, where and how do you folks all meet together? Because you're working on the same kinds of issues, but where do you hang out when you're working on these kinds of things? Is there a forum? Is it to do with green care? Where do you, Eileen, tell me.
Serendipity is what brought us together again.
Oh, goody.
We met Annie and Andrea at the BC Quality Forum in 2021, I believe. Hmm. And then after that, we got together. She asked me to join Nourish. And then after that, I met Elaine. Elaine and I and Jose formed cohort number 3, I believe, of Nourish, with the 3 health authorities working together collaboratively alongside with existing Annie's cohort. So we don't meet formally, but we do informally interact throughout our
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this informal meeting on air. This has been a wonderful show with all of you, with your perspectives, which really are so congruent. I mean, there's so much collaborative thoughts rolling in around in your minds and in the work you're doing. So I want to thank Jose, Elaine, Eileen, and Annie. It's almost like a poem, for being with us today. It's been a wonderful experience for me. Thank you very much for joining us on Food Conversations.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure.